Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
Welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. Returning is a friend of ours. He's been on the show a bunch of times. Last time he was here, he brought with him a record called American Garden, which to me, and it's funny because just off mic we were just talking about this, to me was in many respects a bit of a warning of what we would be could be facing in our lives. And now he's here with a new record called Sudden Signs of Grace. And I'm kind of hoping that since American Garden was that warning, Sudden Signs of Grace is our tunnel out of this. I'm hoping.
Wow, that's some heavy responsibility.
Well, deal with it. Deal with it, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome back to the show, Mr. Tom Guerra. How are you, Tom?
I'm great, Mark, and thanks so much for having me on the show once again to talk this time about the new album, Sudden Signs of Grace.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you would release such a joyful record in the middle of a pandemic. And a world that we're living in.
Who knew that we were going to be in this? And what happened was we finished mastering the record on March 13th, which was the Friday, basically the Friday before the world shut down, or at least America. And So then I had the decision, you know, should I hold this thing or should I put it out? And I was talking to a dear friend of mine later in the month of March, John Butcher, and who was on my last record, and I was on his last record. And I said, you know, I really, really like this record, but I don't know if I should put it out. And you know, this is the worst crisis we've seen in America in 102 years, really, mm-hmm. since the Spanish flu pandemic.
Yeah.
He's like, no, man. He goes, now people need music more than ever. Put it out. Put it out. And I did. It came out in late May, and I think that was the right decision. Based on the feedback I've gotten, and I know from my perspective it feels good because I want to put it out there because I do think people need a distraction these days. I mean, everybody's binge watching this and binge watching that, and it's sort of my 40-minute contribution to the world of distraction, I guess, you know.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. After I heard the record, you were nice enough to send me a copy. When I heard the record, I immediately let you know that I considered it sonic joy.
Oh, that's great to hear because that, you know, that's the ultimate, I guess, reward on my end is if somebody is moved by it and maybe can feel good about things and positive, and that's kind of, that's what it's all about, you know?
Yeah. You always seem to kind of step it up with each record regarding your playing, obviously your songwriting, and the production as well. This record is very lush. And I think that speaks to that sonic joy that I was talking about. That you know, I love records that are lush. Not that I don't love records that are more lo-fi too, because
I really
enjoy that as well. As a matter of fact, I'm working on one that's incredibly lo-fi right now. But
yeah, but
this is so lush and has so many beautiful layers to it. It's kind of that wonderful onion to peel. You use a lot more acoustic guitar on this record than you have in previous records.
Yeah.
And the acoustic guitar work on here is great.
Well, thank you. For whatever reason, you know, after we did American Garden, which had a lot of rock and roll stuff on it.
Yeah.
And part of that was because some of the songs I had written for the Yardbirds, and so there's sort of that rock feel, you know, with harmonica and sort of a good riff and everything. This time around, it was just really, really focused in on the writing, and was writing with this little acoustic that I have. It's an old Gibson LG1. LG1 is Ladies Guitar 1. I mean, it's a small guitar. But it just, the only way I can describe it is this thing had a lot of songs in it, maybe still has a lot of songs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they started. And regarding your comments on production, you know, I love playing live, and I love lo-fi records as well. I mean, some of Muddy Waters' Chess stuff.
Yeah.
That I have, that I love, was recorded probably with one or two mics in the room.
Yeah.
You know, everything, and it's the ultimate lo-fi and it's real. But when I'm doing my own solo records, you know, I focus in on trying to get and develop the songs to be as interesting and as maybe sonically pleasing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of the songs have layers of harmony vocals on it. Kenny did a great string arrangement for Inspiration and Memories, one of the songs on it, and that really is beautiful. That came out great.
Yeah.
And we just did a video for that was released this week.
Great video,
and
too.
Thank you. I'm glad you got a chance to see that. And so, you know, I want to keep improving as a writer, and a lot of these songs have sort of not the traditional cowboy chords that we all use and love and play, but maybe a little bit more diverse and a little bit more interesting from a chordal perspective.
Yeah, more inversions.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I can hear that, especially with some of the stuff that you did, like on Lover's Time with the 12-string. And
yep. No, that's exactly right. And that song, I mean, you know, there's a big modulation in the middle.
Yeah.
It's got a decent bridge that I think takes it onto the next level. And of course, there's a lot of cowbell in it. More cowbell.
More cowbell. Yeah. I'm going to jump around and talk about titles.
Sure.
There's one track for me that I got turned on about 2 years ago, I guess it was now. I got turned on to a guitar company from Canada called Mackenzie and Marr.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And they were nice to send me. I told them, I was like, boy, that they had this one 00 parlor guitar that I had heard that I was like, wow, that thing is really sounds great. I wonder if it sounds that great in person. So they sent me one.
Yeah.
And I lost my mind. I can't put it down. It's made me play so much more acoustic guitar now. And and when I heard your guitar work, which is absolutely beautiful on Lonely No More.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I heard that guitar on that soloing on the outro, I was like, yep. Wow, that's that sound. Was that a parlor guitar? What kind of guitar was that?
Well, it's not really a parlor guitar, but it's the LG1 Gibson.
Oh, okay.
That's the only acoustic I played on this thing. And it is, you know, it is a smaller body guitar. It's got a great neck on there. I'm sort of embarrassed to admit it, but I've had the strings on there for years. And I love the way it sounds. And it's like, man, I don't know if I want to get rid of it because strings...
Yeah,
sound really, really good. You know,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes if you put new strings on, they sound bright and tinny.
Yeah,
and these definitely sound a little bit more, more well-rounded sounding.
Right.
So I'm leaving them on there till basically I start busting strings and I'll break down and
there you go.
Replace them.
Well, you know, I'm having a conversation with JD Simo, and he says that unless he breaks one, he's not changing them.
Yeah, no, that's probably a good idea. I mean. You listen to, I mean, obviously the ultimate example of that was Duck Dunn on his bass.
Who, yeah.
You know, had strings on his bass for years, and they were coated in barbecue sauce and all sorts of stuff, he said, you know. But, you know, Lonely No More, that was one I wrote, obviously, on acoustic. And then I when I tracked it, I said, okay, I'm going to go off a little, do a little solo thing on the end. Which, for some reason, to me, I started thinking, wow, this kind of sounds like Dickie Betts or something, you know?
Yeah, okay. Modally, yeah.
Maybe modally, and so I was going to replace it, you know, with an electric, but then I started, you know, the more I worked on that song and we put other instruments in, I worked on the vocals, I really, really liked that sound of the acoustic lead, so I'm like, I'm leaving it, you know? I mean, I don't need to play electric guitar on every song, and so we left it, and I like it. It really sounded nice.
I'm so glad you left it. It's so good. It's one of the highlights for me because it just caught my ear immediately. I was like, ooh, here's something. Oh, that's great. That's not something that you would hear all the time, and that's, you know,
right.
And I think
right.
That's kind of what, you know. Right, there's only a certain amount of chords. There's only 12 notes. We need to continue to try and find interesting ways of using them, and to me, that's you did that with that. So
and on the turnaround in that song, it's like I used a little bit of an inversion that I had never used before, kind of going from the minor six to a sharp five on there, and it's because I'm like, wow, that, I've never heard that in a song before, but mm-hmm. I like the way that kind of It kind of sets you off a little bit when you hear that. It's not, you're not expecting that,
mm-hmm.
and that was sort of a something that was pleasant that I stumbled upon.
That's cool. That's so cool. So I have to say, when I heard the title track, "Sudden Signs of Grace," I got this feeling. I mean, because I love what Kenny's doing with the fretless bass on there.
Yes.
First off, I just lose my mind over fretless bass, especially against a Caribbean rhythm. You know,
yeah,
there's something about that. Those two worlds just are so perfect together, and it gave me this. It has a very world music sound to it.
Definitely, and I've heard that from other people as well, and somebody said, you know, it reminded them of something off Paul Simon's Graceland. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'll take that.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Guy's a great songwriter, you know?
Absolutely, one of the greatest songwriters of our generation.
Yeah, it didn't set out to be world or whatever, but I just kind of knew the groove I wanted, and Mike the drummer, who lives down your way, and Kenny and I kind of like, okay, this is what we got here. Let's see what we can come up with. And Kenny's like, oh, I got to play fretless on this thing. And I'm like, good, man. So he did it, and it came out great. I mean, it's a short song. It's, I think, 2 minutes and 20 seconds or something, but... Right. It just kind of came together nicely, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, I wrote that thing in 2020, you know, at the beginning of the year. It was the last song I wrote. I was done with this album, and then I came up with this other tune. I said to Kenny, I said, man, I gotta play this thing. I want to see what you think. And he was like, he goes, definitely gotta put this thing on there, you know. And so it not only became, you know, the last song we recorded, but we named the CD. I named the CD after the album after it.
Yeah, it's like I said. I think it's the it's a perfect name for the record. And by the way, I wanted to take it just a second, folks. For those of you who aren't buying physical copies of music anymore, for those of you who are just either streaming, mm-hmm. you know, or purchasing or downloading or whatever, I have to say the packaging on this record, you really must have spent a lot of time with it because it's so great. I was so thrilled to have liner notes to read.
Yeah.
You know, because...
Well, you know, you and I have discussed this in the past, Mark. We're about the same age.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how we learned about our music when
yeah.
we were growing up. I mean, there was no internet. And so how many thousands of hours did we spend listening to our favorites and reading every note on that liner note, you
yeah.
know, every word on it. So
absolutely.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's go ahead.
Where can people buy it if they want
yes,
a physical copy?
Yeah, so you can get you can stream it or download it. All of the sites: Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Amazon. You can buy it on Amazon as well, but the best place to buy it is my website, which is tomgura.com, TOMGURRA.com, and we ship it out to you, and you get it in 2 or 3 days, and it's, you know, it's $10, and
super cool.
It's like you said, I still listen to music in the album format, so I wanted to make sure this thing was sequenced properly. And that was probably the toughest challenge I had on this record, was how do you sequence it? Because in the past,
mm-hmm.
when you're doing a rock and roll record, you know, it's easy. You can hit them hard, but you can sort of bring the tempo down, bring it up again. But this is not a traditional rock and roll record.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, normally if it was, I would have started with the track Down the Farm, which is a straight ahead Chuck Berry type of rocker.
Right.
But I'm like, yeah, I can't do that because then I'm going to be sending the wrong message for the rest of the album, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely hear that. And it's funny you should mention Down on the Farm, because I didn't really think Chuck Berry. I was thinking more, I don't know, for some reason, but I was listening to it. I was actually listening to it again this morning, and I was in the kitchen, and I was pouring myself a cup of coffee, and that track came on, and I don't know, for some reason, I started to do the twist.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Well, it's a pretty twisted song, so that's appropriate. Oh, man.
So, yeah, I got a little, instead of Chuck Berry, I got a little Chubby Checker instead.
Yeah, well, it's got that kind of groove to it, and you know, I asked Ian Hunter to play piano on that, and I don't know if you saw that in the liner notes.
Yeah.
And because he's really into Jerry Lee Lewis. That's his favorite
yeah.
piano player.
Yeah.
And this is like the closest thing I've ever done to Jerry Lee Lewis. And he got back to me and he said, you know, sounds great as is. You don't need me, you know, cluttering up the track, you know. And I said, well, that's great. Thank you. I've never felt so good about being rejected. the fact that he said it sounded good as is was enough. I'll take it, you know.
That's super cool. What possessed you to decide to do the song Streets of Baltimore, which is, such a great song.
Yeah. So I've always, just from the beginning of time, since I was aware of Graham Parsons, I've been a huge Graham Parsons fan, because he had so much soul. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't think of what he did as soul music. He called it cosmic American music, but it is, to me, soul music, because you could feel a very deep place it was coming from. And last year I was on a long trip by myself. I was visiting a friend in New Hampshire, and I had like the Graham Parsons anthology on there, and that track came on, and I started singing along with it, and I realized, wow, this is right in my range. And then I had the idea, okay, I'm going to cover this, and just, you know, I record songs in the studio all the time, and if I like them, sometimes they go on the albums. And I talked to a friend of mine who is a great guitar player, and also a great pedal steel player, and he's played with Warren Zevon and Ginger Baker, and he's got a great resume, but his name is Scott Rath. And I said, Scott, I'd love to have you play pedal steel on this. What do you think? And he's like, okay, cool. So I sent him the track. And he did a great job on the pedal steel. And so, I mean, I covered it. I wanted it to be close as a tribute to Graham. Not that, you know, he would ever need me to remind people of his greatness, but it was my way of paying tribute to him, because I love his music so much. And I also went to the Joshua Tree Inn a number of years ago, where he spent his last night, and kind of paid homage to him there as well. So, when that track was done, I said, yeah, I'm going with this.
That's so cool.
We did a little tribute video to him as well.
And I assume nobody wore a nudie suit when recording this.
No, I would have loved to, though, you know, but I think there was tequila involved.
I'm sure there was.
So we got that top.
The other cover on the record is a track that I love, and from my fellow Long Islander, from when I was back in the day, I remember him. Yeah. I remember him in because he went to Island Tree schools. I went to Levittown schools.
Okay.
So we I used to see him at the village. What was it called? The Greens. He would hang out at the Greens, okay. And the bowling alleys. He was way older, but we always were like, oh man, he's so cool. And it was,
that's cool. Yeah, that's cool. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Eddie Mahoney. Or Eddie.
Yes, Eddie Mahoney.
Eddie Money. Eddie Money. Yeah. Everybody thought he was cool. Everybody knew his dad was a cop and, you know, all that stuff. But it was so cool that you did Give Me Some Water. I love that track.
Yeah. I met him back in 86 when I was out in Los Angeles. And we kind of hit it off. And he knew some of the people. I had just done a little guitar work for Max Weinberg, who had written a book called The Big Beat. And I got to play guitar with him. And so as soon as I saw Eddie, you know, I was like, hey, man, I'm a guitar player from back east. You know, I just played with Max Weinberg. He goes, oh, I know Max, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we kind of had this little bit of a connection there. And he was very, very cool and encouraging to me. He wanted to bring me into the studio. And things got kind of messed up. But anyway, then fast forward, and we talked about Give Me Some Water, because I said, man, I saw you at the Yale Bowl in 79, and it was 110 degrees, and I said, the best track that anybody played all day was Give Me Some Water, because it was hot, you know, and the band rocks too, great,
yeah.
Jimmy Lyons on guitar,
yeah.
And he said, well, you know, that the thing about that track is when we played the Us Festival, it was the same type of thing, and we had Bill Graham turn on all the fire hoses. So we kind of talked about that track, and then last summer, when I had heard that he was really, really sick, I'm like, oh man, I want to reach out to him. So I was going to just, you know, email him, but then I said, you know, I'm going to send him this track. So I recorded the track, pretty much a demo version of what you're hearing here, and sent it out to him. And then like the next week, he passed, unfortunately. So I didn't really hear back from him, but I did hear from from the MTV VJ Martha Quinn that she really liked the version that I did. So
that's cool.
So that was kind of nice because she was friends with Eddie.
Yeah, it's a great version. I really love it. Anytime I hear his music, it takes me back to where I grew up. You know.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, the thing I loved about that guy is, you know, what defines a great singer, you know, a great mm-hmm. rock and roll singer. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, if you can hear that guy singing three or four words and you know who it is, he's that distinctive. Yeah. He is a great rock and roll singer. And I think he was, you know, I mean, the same goes for Paul Rogers, of course, or Mick mm-hmm. Jagger or Freddie Mercury. I mean, you hear the guy singing three or four words and you know who it is.
Right. Right. Once again, the ear immediately picks it up. Sort of like what I was saying about the acoustic guitar before. You know, it's like oh, it immediately attracts your ear. And it was funny. I was talking to my daughter last night. She's going to be 19, and she's a musician. She's working on her first record, and her and I were talking about. She heard me listening to. Queen's third record, Sheer Heart Attack.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a big Queen fan too.
That's
And she says, "Oh my God." She goes, "So what's your favorite track on this record?" I was like, "Well, that's kind of hard." I says, "But I'm going to say, just for pure angst, I'm going to say Stone Cold Crazy." You know,
sure.
I said, "But you know," I says, and then she says, she mentioned Night at the Opera and Death on Two Legs. And that record came out in 1975. And I said, you know, I said, when I think of 1975, I think of all the gigantic records that came out that year and that we just don't see that level of gravitas in a year as far as releases that are such monumentally changing records.
I was just going to say monumental records, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so I said, let's do a Google search. I said, you know, rock albums that were released in 1975.
Yep.
So we really narrowed it. It was, we literally both were like our jaws were dropping. Oh my God, that too? Oh my God, that too?
Yep.
It just went on and on. And, you know, and once again, that speaks to that, you know, great singers. Great songs, great albums as wholes, as a whole, you know, a statement, not just great, a couple of great songs. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's kind of crazy, man. And you know, even though Eddie, you know, he lived his life in many respects as a guy who, you know, put out a lot of great singles, and that's what kept the record company bringing him back for more. He also had really great records, really great albums.
He really did,
yeah,
he did.
So, but
it's. I mean, we were kind of, you know, growing up in the 70s, right at what I would consider the tail end of like the glory days or the golden age of rock and roll. I mean, and to me, as far as record production, when the 80s happened and the whole MTV thing and the synthesized drums and everything,
mm-hmm.
I never really liked that sound. So I love the sound of like some of the great late 70s records, production wise, such mm-hmm. as Steely Dan Asia, for example.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I mean, I can remember going into a stereo shop and listening to that. It was about a half mile from my house, and I'd walk down there every Friday night as a 13 or 14 year old, and hang out with these guys that my brother and I used to call the fabulous furry freaks. You know, hey man, check this out, Steely Dan Asia. And they dropped the needle on this thing, and the sound would be coming through these big like Klipshorn speakers or something,
right?
And it was amazing sounding. Yeah. And I had never heard music that sounded that great, so that's kind of my frame of reference. I mean, even Hotel California is a well-played record. It's almost overplayed, but Bill Simzik's production on that is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is like the best sound for a record from that, you know, that period. You know, Jack Douglas did a great job with Aerosmith's Toys and Rocks, and mm-hmm. he's another guy that I really admire. Almost got to work with him too on that Yardbirds thing too.
Yeah, he it's funny. He did a record after Guns N' Roses broke up and Slash had finished with the Snake Pit thing. He had Slash did this one record. It was just called Slash, and it was the record was called Ain't Life Grand.
Okay.
And Jack Douglas produced it. And it is honestly the best recordings of that guitarist, whoever the singer was. I can't remember the man's name, but he was brilliant.
It wasn't Miles Kennedy, was it?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's called Ain't Life Grand. I think it's a near, I think with the exception of maybe one song, it's a perfect record. It reminds me of Rocks in many respects, as far as the vibe and the intensity, and it's great. And it's funny because I was at a party for Cheap Trick, and Jack was there because Jack has a long-standing relationship with Rick and everybody. And I had a chance to chat with him, and I said, "Man, I got to tell you, I really loved that Slash record, Ain't Life Grand." He goes, "Oh, you were the one who heard it."
Really.
So I guess it was that poorly received, you know, because it came out, that record came out the same time as, like Tony Braxton and Biggie Smalls was still alive.
Oh, yeah.
And the Titanic soundtrack was hitting, was like just swallowing everything alive. And,
right.
You know, it was that time period for music. So, you know, it got completely buried and just fell under white noise. And a lot of people don't realize how great that record is. And that singer is stupendous. I think as far as rock singers go.
Out.
Yeah, I think it's a great record. And Jack is an amazing producer. I mean, the first Cheap Trick album and Aerosmith Rocks are the two records that are going to be played at my memorial.
Oh, jeez. Well, hopefully that's not anytime soon.
No, but I expect everybody to sit there and listen to the whole damn thing.
Wow. Rocks to me is like the apex of American hard rock. I mean, that's just, and to this day, I mean, I can listen to that and not be sick of it, you know?
And an amazing headphone album.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, the whole thing when he says, "Looking for Hisuki Joe G Crazy Horse Saloon," and you hear the Spurs.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know Do you know what they use there? It's a great story. I heard Steve Tyler say it once.
Was it like a piece of plywood or something they were standing on?
Plywood in the control room, and they didn't have, obviously they didn't have Spurs, and Steven was wearing Chuck Taylors. So they went ahead and they took a tambourine, they cut it in half with a hacksaw, and they duct taped it to his chucks.
Oh, jeez. That's great. I've got a funny story on that album. You know, after school, my buddies and I would get together at one of our houses and listen to albums, you know. And I was over a friend of mine's, and his father was elderly, and his father was probably, I don't know, close to 70 at that point. His father came into the room right at the beginning of Nobody's Fault, where you have sort of that sort of mysterious, almost like organ sounding,
the
faded
Morley pedal swells,
and then, and then it kicked in, and his father jumped about 3 feet in the air, and it was the funniest story, and I did share that with Jack Douglas as well.
That's great.
Yeah,
I love that record, but yeah, you know, you're so right about these sonic records that came out, you know, these sonically rich and lush, and you know, getting back to your record too, a lot of these stereo salesmen would use these records to sell stereos.
Absolutely.
You know, Asia, Wish You Were Here. You know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Dark Side
of the Moon. I mean, these records were just so... There was so much care, and there was so much thought that went into the production to take you somewhere. And that's what it was really all about. Now, today, often enough, it's not about taking you somewhere.
That's right.
And that's...
And keep in mind, all of the editing was done with, you know, razor blades
and Scotch tape.
Exactly. I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing. It is. And that's why I appreciate this record so much, your record so much, is because it has that lush. You can tell there was so much care. Like I said, I think this is definitely by far sonically your best sounding record. So you're I don't know if you can do better next time, or you've painted yourself into a corner. So I don't know.
I don't want to repeat myself. So you'll probably hear something very different next time.
Good for you.
You know, I mean, who knows? I mean, I don't know where it's going to go, but I just want to keep writing, and I am continuing to write and come up with melodies that I think are interesting and making things work for, you know, we're all kind of, you know, our styles are forged by our limitations.
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of what we have to work with. So that's when things get really interesting.
Right. Absolutely. I gotta talk about my favorite song on the record. And, you know, I thought that, you know, usually I vacillate, but this particular song keeps pulling me back because it's just, first off, I love instrumentals. And second of all, the haunting nature of it is just so beautiful. And I feel I can feel it wash over me, which I really love. And it's this track called It's called Sleep Song.
What Sleep Song? Yeah. Well, that one again. I was like, do I even put this on here because it is an instrumental? But then when I was doing the sequencing, I'm like, ah, that's where it fits. This is going to be the end track on here. You know, if you listen to a lot of great albums, you know, I mean, have ending songs that are sort of a little bit mellower, like Moonlight Mile on Sticky Fingers or Home Tonight on Rocks. You know, we're just talking about that,
right?
And that's where that one fit best. And it does sort of, it's got a good vibe to it. You know, I love the vibe to that.
Yeah, tell me now. I imagine you must have dug deep into your collection, because everybody who knows you, and including me, knows that you have a pretty nice guitar collection. And so you probably dug deep into the collection for this, or was it no, I'm going to use this and this, and that's all I'm going to use.
Oddly enough, last year, I think it was January of 2019, I came into a really, really nice, clean 59 Strat, three-tone Sunburst, maple neck, super, super light, like barely 7 pounds. And the first day I got it, I plugged it into my Vibrolux Reverb and was just noodling on the thing and came up with that riff that you hear, which is, you know, I'm not a guitar player that does like tapping stuff, you know, but on this particular song, I do like, you know, a bend on my left hand and then just tapping the note on my right hand and then letting it, you know, bend down or go back to pitch. And that's how I wrote that thing. And I'm like, this is a really interesting type of thing. And I kind of came up with relatively straightforward chord pattern on there that I put underneath it. And I'm like, yeah, I liked it. And I played bass on that one, too, because I really worked the bass part out. And I was like, yeah, here, Kenny, here, check this out. And he basically is like, well, I really like this bass part. Do you want me to replicate it? I said, you know, don't even bother. I'm just going to keep my bass part on there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then Matt Ziner, the Hammond player, plays piano as well on here, really did some nice kind of ghosting of what I was doing on the organ, and it really came out nice. There's a lot of space in that song, and it's a really, really clean Strat straight into the Vibrolux Reverb, and it's a beautiful sound, you know.
Is that the Strat that's on the inside of the record?
It is actually. Okay. Yep, that I played that on a couple tunes on here, and so that is the Strat. It's on the back cover, and it's on the inside flap there.
Yep. Yeah,
real nice three tone. And whoever had it before me put some really big frets in it, you know. So normally if I get an original 50s or 60s guitar, I'm always hesitant to put new frets in unless they're absolutely shot, you know, because I believe in playing a guitar. You know, I don't want every guitar to play exactly the same, because if you pick up a guitar and it's got small frets, you're going to play a little different, and I think that's interesting, you know.
Right.
So I got my gig guitar set up, you know, for maximum whatever it is I do, but then I've got some older guitars that are all stock that you just kind of play to the instrument. This thing had big frets on it, so I could kind of play a little bit more in a modern way, and it's a great guitar. I love it.
That's cool. So for the record, is that pretty much, was that the go-to instrument for the entire record?
I'd say that if there was a go-to instrument, it was that LG1 Gibson acoustic.
Right.
But there are a bunch of Strats on there. I used my old SG for the slide lead and Give Me Some Water. I used the 63 Strat. I did also use a 1970 Strat. That is, I think, like a secret weapon, like for the solo on It's All in the Skies. It's a beautiful, thick-sounding guitar solo, and that's just pretty much the 70 Strat straight into the Marshall that I was playing. And that 1970 Strat has very, very weak pickups. So you would normally think, well, this guitar sucks because it has weak pickups. But for whatever reason, maybe because there's not a lot of magnetic pull or whatever on those pickups, it's one of the toniest sounding Strats I've ever owned. So that's kind of like, yeah, that's a keeper. It's definitely not worth as much as a 50s guitar, but playing wise, it's great and it sounds excellent. You know,
did the Wolf make an appearance?
That did not make an appearance. That's actually down in Phoenix right now at the Musical Instrument Museum.
Oh, wow.
That's Howlin' Wolf's 63 Stratocaster. Yeah.
That thing's making the rounds, isn't it?
It is. It was in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then it came back to me, and the Musical Instrument Museum contacted me, as well as a couple rock stars that want to buy the thing, but I'm not really ready to sell it.
Right.
So I restrung it, played it a bit, and sent it down there. I think it was last June. I just talked to them last week too, because they're temporarily closed because of the pandemic. And I said, "Hey, just making sure you guys are, you know, you want to keep in touch with them. They have one of my nicest guitars down there."
Yeah, I tell you, man,
they're going to reopen though.
Before you ever sell that thing, you got to let me know. I just want to play that thing once.
Yeah, sure, man. You know, I've had so many people play it, like and it's a little bit of a challenge. It's got the original frets on there, so it's not going to play like one of your super Strats,
right?
You know, but it will. It's got a killer sound to it. I mean, and I, you know, I'm kind of lucky that I stumbled into that.
Yeah, thing. just to be in the presence of something with that much history. I'm such a history nut, and that has so much history. So, yeah, I would love to be in its presence once for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, man, I got to tell you, this is a really great record. You did it again. And, you know, it's funny as I'm finishing up what I'm working on right now. And it's to hear other people's records, you know, you start to look back at what you're doing and you're going, oh, boy, maybe I better rethink what I'm doing. But, you know.
Well, you know, but it's as long as you're being true to yourself. You know, I mean, I remember for years I'd be like bumming because I can't sing like Paul Rogers or I can't play like this guy. And then a friend of mine who's a drummer, Mike Hayden, said to me, he goes, "You know what? He goes, you know, you can't play like Clapton, but he can't play like you," or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit of a light bulb moment, because if we're true to ourselves and we really feel in our hearts this is what we are meant to be doing, it's going to come through in the music. So I'm sure it's going to be what you're working on. It's going to be great. You know, I mean, that's,
well, it'll certainly believe that. It'll certainly be me. That's for sure.
Right. Right. And that's
warts and all.
That's great.
Warts and all.
I know. Believe me. Believe me. I mean, all my stuff is got it. You know, I think a realness in it. And let's face it. Anybody can make a perfect technically perfect album, but it'd probably be boring as hell, you know?
Yeah, well, this is certainly not technically perfect. And it was what I set out to do, because it was sort of like, I just want to do stuff that's going to be very spontaneous and leave the mistakes in. And, you know, there's this thing that we used to say back when I was in Teaser, we would say, you know, whatever you do, if you make a mistake out there, do it again. This way everyone thinks you meant to do it.
Exactly. You know, the best case of that, I think, is on Live at the Fillmore, or it's from those live sessions where the Almonds are doing Mountain Jam, and Dwayne hits this fabulous clunker in there, and then you hear him do it again, and he kind of makes it into this Egyptian sounded thing, and I'm like, okay, well, he got out of that. Yeah. And that's kind of what it's all about.
I remember one night we were playing, and the band made a mistake together, all four of us.
That's great. We made this, must have been laughing.
It was hysterical, and the drummer, you know, he was wearing a headset, and he had this cackle laugh. He laughed and he went, "Oh my God, it sounded like the record skipped."
That's great. Well, you know, that's what real music is about, you know.
It is.
We're humans.
Yeah.
And we're humans, and so be it, you know.
So when all of this madness is behind us, and I do believe that at some point we're gonna have it's never gonna be exactly the same as it was, but it'll be something new, and it'll be something a little more like normal. Will you take any of this out live now that you have? I mean, you have such you have such a catalog now.
You know, and it's getting back to our earlier discussion about making lush sounding records, right. You know, in a perfect world, I'd be able to take this out and get a bunch of musicians to play it like the albums or whatnot. And I don't know. I mean, I've played so many different styles and different musicians over the years, and I like playing live with my band, the Mambo Sons, and we do throw some of my solo stuff in there. Like we started doing Down the Farm this fall, and it really sounded great live, because it's a rock and roll song, you know, that's a rock and roll band. But I don't really have any overwhelming desire to do that in terms of, you know, putting myself on the road with a band to play my own solo stuff, just because I don't know if I want that level of responsibility and dictatorship in terms of you got to play it like the album or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of want to view these as almost two separate musical paths for me. There's my live path where I'm just playing clubs around the area, and then there's my studio path where I'm trying to focus on really good songs. And I mean, so that's kind of where my head is at these days. And that's, you know, there is no right or wrong, I don't think, as far as this is concerned, because I'm just lucky and fortunate that I'm able to do this, both having the ability to do it, but also the means to do it, and getting my music out there and, you know, letting people hear it from a sonic perspective versus, you know, going to a club and hearing it. And you can hear me that way as well, but it's going to be slightly different. It's going to be, you know, blues-based rock and roll stuff that we're doing.
Well, I look forward to whatever it is that you're going to do, because I really enjoy what you do.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. That makes me feel good.
Good, man. Well, thanks for being on the show again, man. And anytime, I know you and I, we chat a lot via Facebook, and we often are doing our, you know, our forehead slaps when we hear something ridiculous. But
yeah, but I'm again, you know, I'm not out to convert the world to my way of thinking or whatever. So I'm usually trying to use the social media outlets as a way to either promote my music or to talk about guitars and stuff like that.
Right.
Something less controversial, because, you know, I think we know what's right, we know what's wrong, and I think people either get it or they don't get it.
Right. And we went through an entire interview and didn't talk about string gauges.
Yes. And, well, I mean, I'm probably the most boring person in the world because I've used the same strings for 40 years. And those are already all slinkies.
Same you know, here.
So. Yeah. That'll be the next one we can talk about.
Right.
We'll do and pick up resistance and all that good
right
stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff, absolutely.
Yeah.
Folks, the record is called Sudden Signs of Grace, and it is graceful. It's a beautiful record. I highly recommend you get it. And folks, if you are going to stream it, that's fine and dandy. However, if you want and you hear it and you really like it and you want to hear more music like this, then you also need to buy it. Because when you buy it, it allows the artist to make more. So if you want more, buy it. Then stream all you want. Okay?
Very well said. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, sir. Hold on 1 second, but we're going to sign off right here.
Okay.
Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, GuitarRadioShow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
Podcast Productions.